We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by RootMetrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on RootMetrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.
It must be Thursday. Welcome to Learning Unwrapped, talk show about your most important life skill, learning. Today, we're going to be talking about empowering readers. Very excited about the topic. I want to thank International Broadcast Media TV for having this fabulous network and having me host this show. So without further ado, let's get our co-host up here. Now, I usually select a co-host from IDE Corp, my consulting company. And this particular This particular co-host is also one of our directors. So we're taking her out of backstage and she's like gotten all dressed up to be here. Please welcome Carrie Gentner.
Hi.
Hi, Carrie.
So How are you doing?
So I have to tell the audience that you are now Dr. Carrie Gentner, having recently completed your PhD at the University of South Florida.
Yes. And
you completed that. And I always like to point out in educational leadership and policy studies, if there's anyone there from the government, keep an eye out for her. She likes policy. And your dissertation has fascinated me, although I can never remember it. So it is Problematizing Florida's Extended Reading Time Policy, which is for students who are striving to learn, right?
Right.
A critical investigation of place, demographics, and curricula. And
I had to look it up too. I don't remember my title all the time either.
And I always say, Carrie, you're a lifelong literacy specialist and lover of all things literacy. So what did you learn this week?
So this week, I have been reading an audiobook. So listening to an audiobook called What If by Randall Monroe, and it's read by Will Wheaton. And in one of the scenarios he presents, what if you were to actually build a periodic table with the actual elements? And bad things happen, but I learned that bromine and mercury are the only two elements that are in liquid form at room temperature out of all the elements.
Interesting. Bromine and what?
And mercury.
All right. Well, live audience, you can now say that you've learned something here today. And we do want to welcome the live audience. We love the folks who join us live and put your comments. Don't be shy. Put your comments in the chat there. Join us in the conversation. So our question to you is, what did you learn this week? And while you're filling us in on what you've learned, I'm going to talk about our first guest. We do have one of our guests is joining us shortly. And so because she is alphabetically would normally be the first person I'm introducing, we are going to flip it and I'm going to introduce the guests in reverse alphabetical order. That's so that nobody emails me this week telling me I made a mistake. This is intentional. So I don't know if you have ever seen this book, I Love My Hair. I only recently found out that this was written back in 98, I think it was, years ago, but it is like Natasha Tarpley's known book. People love it. I love it. So she is the author of I Love My Hair, and she is here with us tonight. And we'll talk a little bit more about that book, but it is an ode to Black childhood and natural beauty. And if you check it out on YouTube, there is a Netflix bookmark series video of Tiffany Haddish reading the book aloud, and it is phenomenal. She also wrote The Harlem Charade, which was a middle grades mystery with strong social justice themes. And she's written a whole bunch of other books in there as well. And we hope that she keeps on writing. She is a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. Her work has appeared in New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post, Essence Magazine, among other publications. She is the co-founder, I want to hear more about this as well, of Wunderbar Media, a multicultural children's book media company. And she lives with her husband and the ghosts of two cats on the south side of Chicago. Please welcome Natasha Anastasia Tarpley.
Hi.
Hi, welcome, Natasha.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I think I see a cat in the background.
What do you see?
That should have been a cat.
Oh, you're teasing me.
I'm back to my morbid sense of humor again.
I was thinking about using that for what I learned this week, was that Natasha has cats, ghost cats. But speaking of that, Natasha, what did you learn this week?
And this might tie into some of the things we'll get into talking about, but my nephew, who is six, is being homeschooled right now. And my mom is the person who is his primary teacher. And so I've been able to kind of peek into that process. And one of the things that I've enjoyed doing and is talking to him about what he's learned. And so through him and asking him to tell me what he's learned, I've learned quite a bit in terms of little tidbits. Like today I was talking to him and he told me about the origins of Pandora's box, which I personally had never known. So I learned a little bit about Pandora's box, and it was just a pleasure to have him tell me that story.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, that's a good way to learn new things.
Yes.
Right. Well, I look forward to hearing more about your books, your writing, and your goals and what you're doing. We are going to be joined next by Marian Plotinsky, who is a national board certified teacher. She is currently a learning and achievement specialist for Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland. She is a weekly columnist for Education World. So if you haven't read her articles, please check it out. She also writes for Education Week and Edutopia. And she has a book in the works, which we're going to find out more about. She lives in the DC metro area with her husband, three kids, and a dog. Please welcome Miriam Plotinsky.
Hello.
Hi, Miriam. Nice to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Miriam, what is it that you learned this week?
Well, I work with a number of schools in my district, and one of them is a career and technology education school. And over the past couple of weeks, we've been going back in person, and I had the opportunity to visit a cosmetology class and to see the cosmetology class engage in what we call simultaneous or concurrent instruction, which is where you have some kids who are at home and some kids who are in the building. And I've seen that model with English or math or science, but I had not yet had a chance to see it with cosmetology in a beautiful hair salon. It's a classroom, but it's a hair salon. And I learned a lot, not just about how to differentiate and model that process of highlighting hair, which I know nothing about. I also learned that some hair is porous and some hair is not porous. So that was a lot of learning in one place for me.
Right. Well, shout out to that teacher for being
exactly.
Able
to rock. Amazing teacher.
Yeah, that instruction. So that's really pretty good. Do you want to share the name or do you not want to shout out an individual?
I would rather not shout out just okay. In case, but I do work with amazing teachers in Montgomery County, so I'm really grateful.
That's awesome. Well, I'm glad you're here, and you also have more of a secondary perspective to be sharing with us on Empowering Readers. So I hear our third guest has arrived and is backstage. Now, Amelia Larson, if you are an avid show watcher of Learning Unwrapped, you saw her on one of the early shows. She is the Executive Vice President for Innovations and Academic Partnerships at American Reading Company. She was the former Assistant Superintendent of Pasco County Schools, and that's where I met her when she brought us in to start designing LearnerActive technology-infused classrooms in Pasco County. She is dedicated to scaling solutions focused on social justice, equitable outcomes, identity affirmation and system optimization. And she believes that courageous and effective leadership is critical to breaking through the status quo to transform inherently inequitable education systems. So please welcome Amelia Van Name Larson. I got that right. Amelia Van Name Larson.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
Happy to see you. And I had to put the accent on the right syllable.
That's okay. I'm just so excited about Natasha. You have no idea. I'm just like, I couldn't believe it. I was going to be on the show with her. I'm just so excited.
Well, we'll make sure at some point you're up next to one another.
Okay.
And you just came to us from a webinar with Pedro Noguera that you were sponsoring?
Yes. We had Dr. Pedro Noguera and five superintendents and one state commissioner sharing on what they are learning about getting their systems ready, not for the past, but for a different future. So it was an awesome, awesome webinar.
That is wonderful. And you put me to shame when you say his name. Say that again.
Pedro Antonio Noguera.
I love that. Okay, I'm not even going to try. So go ahead, Carrie, take it away.
Welcome back, Amelia. And can you share with us what you learned this week?
So I have to tell you, I am reading a book, Cast, by Isabel Wilkerson. And I have just fallen in love with the way she writes. And I have never read an informational text like hers. And I kept thinking about it. There's so much poetry in talking about a horrible subject. But what I decided that my big takeaway is that if you know how to write narrative, you can present a problem in a way that really moves people. And so I want to be her when I grow up.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, here we are, three amazing guests, all coming with different backgrounds and perspectives. Our topic is empowering readers. And I specifically chose that word because I didn't want it to be about how do we inspire readers? How do we get kids reading? But, you know, that term empowerment means that we provide you with the tools, the venue, the wherewithal to take power over your own reading. So my first question that I think we should talk about is, how do we empower readers? In what ways can we empower readers? Is there anyone who wants to kick it off?
I think that
what happens when I just put it out there. Miriam, go ahead.
I'll take it. I mean, this is by no means a revolutionary idea, but for me, the number one thing that we have to do is provide choice. You know, more often than not, we get into strange power struggles about what exactly kids are reading. And if we look back and we think about why we're doing that, we'll find we don't have much of a reason. And, you know, just an illustration of that, I was talking to my kids about the fact that they are readers. And my daughter was saying that one of her friends doesn't like to read. And I said, oh, you know, tell me more about that. And she said, well, she likes to read comic books. And I said, well, that's reading. You know, that's if you like comic books, you like to read. If we allow students and kids in general to make more choices about what they read, we won't have to worry as much about engaging them or putting them into a situation that forces us to try to do something that is more punitive or at least perceived as punitive or even just a task, right? It's supposed to be an enjoyable process.
Mm-hmm. And when I think about the choice, Amelia, I immediately think of American Reading Company's Pretty Colorful Buckets and how students can just grab the books that they want to read.
Yeah, we work with 250 publishers and we curate the best libraries out there. And we are continually looking at new books coming out and changing books. But I do, in addition to choice and building time for a reading community to emerge, right? So what are the books that you're reading together? Why this book? Why now? And I really believe in empowering readers. You have to talk about how hard this country has worked historically for some kids not to access the best instruction in reading. And so reading is power, reading is privilege, and we need to open people's eyes to that.
Yes, agreed.
Natasha, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with all of those components. I think there's this idea of just, you know, kind of us figuring out what is acceptable reading, or communicating that idea to kids. And I think, as Miriam was saying, that this is something that kids have been very sort of constrained in, you know, that these books are legitimate, these other books are not. What Amelia was saying too resonates with me, because I think, you know, one of the things I've tried to do in my work is not just be representational in terms of writing books of, that feature Black children, but that tell stories that really celebrate who they are beyond a lot of the topics that we sort of shuttle in the direction of kids and community color. Like, for example, you know, engaging kids on racism and all of these things. These are very important topics, but there's also that element of joy that we need to really emphasize, I think, when it comes to reading and allowing kids to bring who they are to the stories that they're reading, and not to, for example, I visited a school one day, and or several years ago, and one day there's a little boy who was in the class, and he just was so reluctant to read the books. But I went over to him and I was talking to him, and I said, well, what are you doing? What are you interested in? And he said, I'm interested in making robots. And so we found a way. I mean, I'm not a classroom teacher, so I understand the need to maintain some sort of, you know, structure in the classroom. But we found a way to integrate that interest and that skill that he clearly had into our discussion and into kind of what he might want to read going forward.
Mm. Yeah. When Amelia was talking, it reminded me of some of the findings from my dissertation. So I looked at the themes that were present in texts that students of color and students in poverty were reading. And a lot of those themes were capitalistic, materialistic, competitive in nature. And we didn't see a lot of the themes of community, of spirituality, of love of earth, of things like that. Right. And so those Eurocentric themes kind of come through. And so that's a little bit of the hidden curriculum that's in our text too, right? It's not just what's there and who's represented, which is also a problem in many cases, but it's also these underlying themes that children can still have difficulty relating to if it's not part of their own culture.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that you bring me to a thought that if we do not also think about the approach of schooling.
At T-Mobile, we believe in putting people first by treating them right. So we've upped the benefits without upping the price. With Magenta Max, you get our best plan for 5G with unlimited premium data that can't slow down based on how much smartphone data you use. Plus, you'll pay zero cost to switch. And bring your phone. We'll pay it off up to $800. Only at T-Mobile.
Device required for 5G. Activate up to 4K or video streams at 480p. 40 gigs high-speed tethering. Up to $800 via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Support charges waived. See details at tmobile.com.
Our pedagogical orientation. Do we really set up our classrooms as a community with a lot of emphasis on collaborative structures and a lot of talk? If kids are oppressed, then it doesn't really matter what book you bring in once in a while. I mean, this is transformative. It truly is transformative, and it's not easy work, but it's the work that is needed for our future.
And what steps would you recommend schools take?
I think that a lot of times, please, I want to add to this conversation. I know we are all geniuses here, but I think a lot of times people look at solutions in a simplistic way, mm-hmm. instead of a journey. And I think that we, like if I'm a principal today, I'm going to have every staff meeting reading something and reading with the teachers. If I don't create a community of readers with the adults, the kids are never going to experience that. If I don't get really juicy books and go over juicy passages that we disagree upon, then the kids are never going to experience that. So I think this is a journey. I think we need to look constantly, not only at the books we have and who is represented, but also the pedagogy that is in our classrooms and how kids are treated and the opportunities that they have. I think that's really critical.
Yeah, I
absolutely agree. You know, but if you think about it, a lot of the time when it comes to reading choices or even curricular choices, we do what we call technical changes versus adaptive changes. So an example of a technical change would be if we think that our reading choices aren't strong enough and they don't have enough representation, we'll go ahead and buy a whole bunch of books that we think represent a wider audience, and we'll put them in the school library and say, we've done our job.
Right.
The underlying issue, which is that people are not going to use them. They don't necessarily have the framework or lens or background or training to be able to implement that quick technical band-aid fix in a more meaningful way. And, you know, one thing that I think about a lot with structures is the ever-present reading log and how teachers will ask sometimes students to read something and then log how many minutes they've read, and they'll reward in this very extrinsic way. And that's an example of a structure that doesn't reach so many children and that is actually punitive or discouraging. And also from a cultural perspective, just very tone deaf. So,
yeah.
Right. Like, why are we tracking the number of minutes? It's not about the quantity. It's about the quality. What did you get from your reading? Did you enjoy your reading? What did it make you think of? Those are the things that we should be logging or journaling, not necessarily, I read 15 minutes, so now I get a sticker on my chart.
Yeah.
Right. And so if we buy the right books, it doesn't necessarily matter if we don't have structures around how to use those books.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love to read. Now, I tend to read more nonfiction than fiction because I just love learning everything I can. And since I write nonfiction books, I tend to be reading it for research as well. But when I have time and I can sit down and just have a book for pleasure, I love reading now. But I didn't love reading when I was young. And I remember when I was like maybe 8 years old, my dad would pay me a quarter to read a book. You know, and that was a lot of money back in the day. And it's interesting because even that didn't get me to want to read. And then there was a book I really liked. I want to call it Beezus and somebody.
Oh, and Ramona and Beezus.
Yeah. Ramona and Beezus. So
that's the elementary teacher.
So I really liked that book. And I guess whatever grade I was in, when the teacher said that we could, you know, go to the library, select a book, I picked up that book again, which I'd read over and over again. And my teacher sat down with me and she said, you know, I think this book is a little easy for you. You know, you probably read it last year or the year before. And I was like, yeah, I did. And she goes, so like, let's get a book that's harder. And it was pulling teeth to get me to read. And yet as an adult, I love to read. So I often think back to how were they disempowering me to want to take charge of my reading, which I do now. That's all I got.
I'm not sure if this is, I mean, this is definitely not the answer to that question, but I really loved what you were saying, Amelia, with what everyone was saying, Miriam also. I mean, I think there is a power dynamic when it comes to, you know, reading and having this kind of just, you know, getting kids to read. Amelia, what you were saying, this idea of approaching reading as a journey or as a community, I think is really significant and very much the way that we should consider, you know, inviting kids into this process. Again, I'm not a classroom teacher, but oftentimes when I go to schools, I can see the fatigue in certain kids when the adults are kind of channeling or gearing the conversation in a certain way. And I think that's also, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, but I think that's also part of the power dynamic. Again, going back to the kinds of books we determine are culturally appropriate or culturally relevant to certain audiences or certain types of readers. And we need to, I think, really engage kids more in that discussion and have them talk about the things that they're interested in. You know, I've seen, I've gone to schools where they've had, for example, a Scholastic book fair. And there have been conversations, you know, sometimes when I go to schools and talk about I love my hair, I really want to get past that sort of issue-oriented conversation and get into what kids are really interested in, what excites them. Because then when I see them go to the book fair, they're not picking up the books about racism or history or those kinds of things. Some of them are, but they want to read the same things. I'm talking about kids of color primarily, that you know, quote unquote, mainstream audiences are reading. They want to see themselves reflected in those pages as well. And I think we just need to really open up our vision of what that means to kids and who gets to make those decisions in terms of what is relevant and appropriate for readers, particularly readers of color.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it also, when we think about the collaboration and the community, and, you know, Natasha, the story you were telling about the child who liked robots, also expanding the whole, you know, the goal of building readers beyond English class. And this is definitely a secondary concern where it's more noticeable because kids are divided out by subject area and departments, but it also affects primary. You know, the whole idea is that you're supposed to be reading in all your classes, different kinds of texts. And the more you make that clear and the more you make it a school-wide effort, the more students know that it's important. And that also that their interests will be nurtured, even if you know, suppose they're not really into English class. No harm, no foul, that's fine. But if they access reading in a different subject area that they really care about, then they're more likely to engage with that text. And so there are all kinds of ways to build these communities of learners, but we can't keep reading in a bubble of just one class or one subject area.
Right.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. As an elementary teacher, thematic units were everything to me. So we were reading science texts and social studies texts and literature throughout the day. It really didn't matter. It was just our whole school day was intertwined and all connected. And I will say that shout out to Bayonet Point Middle School. I know that they are putting, yes, we'll do a shout out. They are putting extra resources, extra support for teachers in science and social studies, not just in the ELA subject areas. So students that need additional support, they need ESE services, they're actually providing those in the science and social studies areas to help them with reading in the content areas. And I thought that was a good step forward to getting all teachers to embrace literacy.
That is great, because I know talking with content area teachers, there is always that thought of, well, why should I be teaching reading? Isn't that the English teacher's job? And I know I met with some teachers and I brought out an article and it happened to be about biology. And I was meeting with high school teachers. So I gave everybody the article and I said, I want you to just read the first two paragraphs. So they did. And I said, now I want you to tell me, what was the conversation in your head as you were reading? What were the questions that you asked? What were the points that made you go, ooh, you know? And it was interesting because as the math teacher and the social studies teacher, you know, were talking about that particular article, they, you know, talked about it on a bit of a surface level or, oh, that was an interesting point. When the science teacher talked about it, it was like, well, this connected to this. And then I was wondering, well, what about that? And well, what? And then I said, well, see, you see? When a science teacher reads an article about science, there's an internal conversation going on that is very rich because of what you're bringing into that conversation. And that's what only you can model to your students. And we need content area people to realize that you model how to read your content because you're a content specialist, not because you're a reading specialist. And I think that's the shift we have to make.
I think, Nancy, you were spot on, because that is part of power, right? That's part of privilege. Is if I only, like, I love romance I fourth grade level, I read all kinds of romance. But if that's all I read, I would not be able to speak the truth. Right. So I think it's really important that, like, I just finished reading a book called Reading at the Speed of Sight. It's probably the hardest book I have read in a very long time. I had to go back and reread and watch and read something else in order to make meaning. Right. Kids also need to know that reading is hard and I need to develop a muscle. So to me, this is about life outcomes. To me, this is about kids not being fooled by bias in how writers write some things. It's for them to be able to detect that a book is one-sided. And I'll tell you, Nancy, like, you know, like, American Reading, we really are a bunch of rebels, right? So I found my place.
That's what I love about you guys.
But we are rewriting history books because we are not finding books that tell the true history of this country.
No.
Now, we're not going to be invited in all places. I can guarantee you we're not. But somebody needs to do it.
Right. Somebody has to take a stand.
Somebody, in what you're saying related to how do I read a history book? How do I talk about it? How do I write my history? Right. So this is all power, guys. This is all about power.
Right. Well, I remember we were talking once about LGBTQ books and where do they belong and will a school not like it because you're not? And yet, how do we become inclusive and create inclusive book collections for students?
And that's tough, right? And sometimes, like, you have to do two things. You have to work with a community to move them forward. But at the same time, every kid has to see themselves in the collections, their perspective. So sometimes we say, like, one time we got a question in the South related to how many times the words enslavement or slaves came up in the Civil War unit. And we go, like, every day, every time. If you don't want that, don't choose that unit. But sometimes you can be a little bit more flexible in saying, if you're not ready for this core text, we can tell you this core text. But in the independent libraries, kids will have access to everything, or we won't wait. Mm.
And I want to go back to the comment you made before about the community of learners. So can we create the community of learners in terms of reading, a community of readers, in terms of allowing students to help select the books that will be part of the classroom library and to help select then the books that or be able to, as Miriam talked about choice, be able to select the books that they're reading and be able to get together with their peers to engage in discussions around those books and being given the tools to think about how to read and discuss those books. Like, what are some tips you might give teachers for creating communities of readers?
Well, a lot of the time it gets back to structures again in a classroom. So for example, if there's a reason that the whole class has to be reading a text together and that's a legitimate reason, that's fine. And that happens a lot. However, if you alternate and you have some balance, do literature circles or book club groups that involve more self-selection, and then you also have that really important student-to-student discourse piece where they're having discussions about reading based on books that they're enthusiastic about. And, you know, the other thing is we mentioned libraries, and I think that school libraries play such an important role in this process because, you know, if you look at your average department storeroom, there's not a whole lot of choice or variety there with text, but if students are able to go to libraries and interact with texts and work with media specialists, learn more about what they like, that also opens up the field for what kids can read and what they would like to collaborate on. So you can take, you know, it's very feasible for a teacher to create a structure. They only have 5 copies of a book instead of 30. So that's a literature circle right there.
Right.
And read that and talk about that. And it creates all kinds of options.
And imagine if you had different books and you allowed students to just select the literature circle they wanted to join. And so everybody selects the circles they want to join, and then they get to engage in reading the books that they want to read. And perhaps even as a result of that, come out with some other books they might be interested in reading or some other topics they might be interested in reading about.
I saw a really fun tweet today. It was somebody who posted bookmarks for their younger grades, so probably second, third grade students, and they were text twins. And so they were color coded so that you and your text twin had the same color bookmark. And then there were different questions on there for the students to engage with. So as they were reading that book, you know, side by side reading, they would actually have like some prompts there of how they could talk with one another about the book. So I thought text twins was a really fun way to get students talking about books, but it might kind of be uncomfortable if you don't know how to have that conversation.
Right, right. Well, you said the word bookmarks, Carrie, and that got me thinking of...
With MailChimp, you get more than a URL. You get an all-in-one marketing platform to help drive sales with things like data-driven recommendations and powerful automation tools. Get started today at MailChimp.com/smartmarketing. MailChimp, built for growing businesses.
At T-Mobile, we believe in putting people first by treating them right. So we've upped the benefits without upping the price. With Magenta Max, you get our best plan for 5G with unlimited premium data that can't slow down based on how much smartphone data you use. Plus, you'll pay zero cost to switch. And bring your phone. We'll pay it off up to $800. Only at T-Mobile.
Capable device required for 5G. Activate up to 4K or video streams at 480p. 40 gigs high-speed tethering. Up to $800 via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Support charges waived. See details at T-Mobile.com.
What's in your mug? But to dive into this, I have a question for Natasha. I was reading an interview from about a decade ago or so. And in that, the last question was, do you favor peach cobbler over beignets? And you chose peach cobbler. And I was wondering if you're sticking with that 10 years later.
I'm sticking with it.
Are you?
Yeah. All right. Nothing against beignets, but I do love the peach cobbler.
Well, because in my mug today is Café du Monde coffee, home of the beignet. So I thought that was quite funny that I read that article. And my mug basically says every book you've ever read is just a different combination of 26 letters. Carrie, what's in your mug?
Well, the mug that I wanted, I have water in it, and it is Pride and Prejudice. Oh, can you see it? There we go. I love Pride and Prejudice. Definitely my favorite book. I read it once a year. And then the mug that was fun, I got bookmarks are for quitters.
Oh. That's what got me thinking of it's time for what's in your mug. Amelia, what's in your mug?
So I have to tell you, I just got this gift. Office goddess.
Oh.
Because now
and you are.
Well, there is no office. It's a home office and there's nobody else in it. So I am the office goddess.
You're the goddess of your own office. And what's in it?
Water, sorry.
Water, just no, that's okay. That's okay. Just hydrating. Natasha, what's in your mug?
An audience. So I brought a Zabar's mug. From a store in New York City called Zabar's.
Shout out.
And I've been feeling, yeah, very wistful. I lived in New York for many years and I live in Chicago now. And because I usually go back once or twice a year, but because of the pandemic, I, you know, wasn't able to travel. So I started getting Zabar's shipped to me in Chicago. So I have my Zabar's mug and my Zabar's coffee to remind me of New York City.
That is great. That is great.
So you live in Chicago?
I live in Chicago right now, yeah.
One of your favorite cities.
But she gets all of her coffee from New York.
Yeah. Right.
Miriam, what is in your mug?
Well, I have my beach mug. This is a Rehoboth beach mug, which is in Delaware. I live near D.C., so this is a place we typically, pre-pandemic, go in the summertime, and we'll go again.
Love Rehoboth Beach.
It's wonderful. It's relaxing. I really miss the beach. My whole home office here is a beach theme. Mm-hmm. So I can end. It's not working so well. the idea that I'm pretending that I'm surrounded by beach. So I've got my beach mug, and it's got Cherry Coke Zero in it.
Cherry Coke Zero.
Which is my substance of choice.
Wow. And maybe you just need to throw some sand on the floor.
That would be fantastic. But since I clean the house, that would almost be like doing myself in.
I love it. I love it. All right, let's get the conversation continuing on. Carrie.
Sure. So I was just thinking about, you know, thinking back as a student myself and the things that I love to read and what made me feel engaged and empowered. And I was wondering what book or maybe what time do you remember engaging with a book that made you feel engaged or empowered? Yeah, it's a toughie. You got to think back on this one.
This is a personal example, but my father would read to me out loud once a week until I was a high school graduate. And we read everything from Pride and Prejudice, which is also something I read at least once a year, to when I was younger, the Anne of Green Gables series or just any books because my father is a retired English professor. And I think that the balance of having that special time to read with an adult mm-hmm. is what made me feel empowered as a reader. Like I could access a book that meant something to me, especially because the books I was seeing in school weren't doing that for me.
Yeah. Wow.
And maybe that's what my father should have done, is read to me instead of paid me.
Well, there are a lot of studies about parents who read to children. And
yeah.
How powerful that is.
Yeah. And my parents didn't read to me, and not that they couldn't, but I, you know, for whatever reason, perhaps back in the day, that wasn't the thing to do. And I do think that that had an impact, because what my dad did do with me was build all sorts of things. You know, we hear my stories about building clubhouses and I remember we built this huge barbecue pit out of stones and we cemented them together. I learned to do so much math. I ended up becoming a math teacher. And I think it was because he had influenced me so much in that area. And I want to bring up again Natasha's book, because this is a book that you wrote that I know Amelia's all excited, because this is a book that you wrote about, I mean, not about, but inspired by your relationship with your mom. So tell us more about your mom's influence in your reading.
Yeah, like Miriam was saying, I had parents who, you know, did read to us when we were younger. And I have strong memories, and I'm so thankful for these memories, because my dad died when I was 12. But I have memories of him reading a couple of stories to us that have just stayed with me. And I think really opened up not just the story on the page, but the kind of the sensory experience of reading. He would read a book about a soldier that had a drum, and he would make the sounds of the drum and things like that. He would read a story about someone who, a farmer who made a big cheese and was taking it. It's a well-known story, but he was taking it to the king, and along the way, everyone, you know, wanted a slice of his big cheese. And that just, like, I don't know, those things made some really powerful connections to me in terms of books and reading as a way to enter a whole other world and other experience. So that was one thing. My mom also, when we were younger, I don't know if I mentioned this, but I have three siblings. There were three girls and one boy. I'm the oldest. And my mom, as we were growing up, would write these little stories about the things that we did, the things that we were interested in. And so again, that made a connection to me. Between sort of my life and the kinds of experiences that I'd had, and how that might be something that could go into a story. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about having siblings is that you always have to share stuff. So getting my hair combed was the one time when I didn't really have to share my mom. It wasn't my favorite thing to do, but it was the one time when we had this really special time together. And what she would do during that time is pretend that there were people who lived in my hair. So this is like a whole little story time thing, creative story time game that we would play while she was combing my hair. And so we would, you know, to distract me from the tangles, we would just make up these little stories and characters as we went around, you know, my head and, you know, what's Mrs. Bryant doing today? And, you know, those kinds of things. So the people who lived in my hair, you know, didn't make it into I Love My Hair, but that essence of sort of the sharing time and that creative time and the imagination, those are the things that I really wanted to convey. It wasn't a book about, well, you should love yourself because you're great. You know, that this whole kind of messagey thing, it was more like, how do you enter your own world of imagination and creativity and joy and whimsy as a means of sort of getting to know and celebrating who you are. And in particular, maybe something that you may not, that's maybe a challenge for you in terms of, we all have these things about ourselves that, you know, can be challenging. And so it's not just hair for somebody else. It might be their nose or whatever, but, you know, just kind of opening up that space of creativity and imagination around those types of topics.
Mm. And you have a follow-up book to that, right? You have I Love My Haircut?
Yeah, there was a companion book that came out. The original title of it was Bippity Bop Barbershop, where the little girl, Kiana, from I Love My Hair, her brother, Miles, goes to the barbershop with her dad. And again, hair in that book, too, is used as a vehicle to really celebrate and explore that sense of community and that bond that happens within a barbershop, that, you know, that that's a space culturally, not just in African-American culture, but culturally that, you know, has been a gathering place, a place where people could talk freely and feel a sense of community and safety and celebration of who they were, particularly as Black men. But now it's kind of it's expansive. So there are women and all kinds of people in the barbershop.
Mm. And you're going to keep writing for us, right?
Absolutely. I've been writing since I was 7. I don't think that I've tried many other careers. I went to law school. I took college classes thinking I might be a professor, but writing has been the one thing that is consistent. So,
Natasha, let's talk.
Yes.
I'll connect the two of you.
Right.
And Miriam, you are working on a book. So tell us about that.
Essentially, I really like thinking about different ways to help students own their learning a lot more than they do. And I think we've been talking about that a lot today. So essentially, I'm trying to come up with some hands-on strategies for teachers so they can just step back a little bit from sort of constant oversight and allow students to really be an equal part in creating a shared community of learners.
Mm, love it.
And you know, for me, a lot of the time when we talk about how we help teachers from the perspective of a writer or someone who's not necessarily in a classroom at that moment, one of my biggest philosophies is that we have to give teachers tools they can use right away that are immediately accessible and applicable to their teaching because, you know, a lot of the theories are great and they're really helpful, but then they have to translate to action to people who are right there in the trenches.
Exactly. Yeah, because especially now, teachers are so stressed with so many things that if you can give them oxygen, you know, if you can give them what they need to make it work now, that is going to be so valuable. So Amelia, I want to go back to what Carrie said. When was the time you were really empowered and inspired in a book?
So I became a reader with Pride and Prejudice in seventh grade. I truly did become a reader because of romance.
I never got into that.
Really?
What is wrong with me?
I don't know.
Pride and Prejudice.
I do.
Well, it's not just that. I've read all of them. I've read all the Jane Austen books, but I come back to Pride and Prejudice every single year. It's just the
one. Every time you read it, you see something new.
Absolutely.
I always find something new.
Oh, I'm going to have to read
too.
It. All right, Amelia. Back
I'm sorry,
to
you. Amelia. Keep going. Sorry.
And then in college, I discovered a different type of reading, and Paulo Freire was my professor in college. So,
was he really?
Yeah. So he introduced me to some. I was 18 years old. My parents freaked out because they thought I was going to be a rebel for the rest. And he did change me. So I learned a different type of book. But now I'm learning to read as a grandmother. And this is the reason I'm so in love with Natasha, because my 10-month-old grandson, he comes and he spends every Wednesday with me. Oh. And he has books that he chooses from. And Natasha's book is a book that he chooses every time. Oh. And it's because of the sound. He's 10 months, guys. So just let's go there. A 10-month-old is choosing. He goes for it. He drops on the book. He turns the pages. But I think that it's your book is musical. It has all these kinds of sounds. And he likes to hug, you know, and all the pages where the mom is holding and hugging. So I am also writing two books. And it's for ARC. It's not for outside or anything like that. But it's how I want teachers to talk to kids about reading. And one is your learning brain and the other one is your reading brain. And one of the things that I get scared about with waves that come and go in education is that some kids have access to everything. And then we start saying, oh, when you're teaching kids in school, don't do this, do that, right? And one of the things that really concerned me is this idea that when kids are learning to read, that they shouldn't have books with illustrations. It should be plain books. Hmm. And I'm going like, are you kidding me? That's not what I want for my grandkids. Because the meaning comes, like, if you take your book, Natasha, you can get meaning just from the illustrations that are not even in the words.
Yes.
So how am I going to take illustration away from kids when kids are learning to read? If you need to do something, cover the darn picture for a little bit, but then don't take illustration away. So I think we need, for equity, guys, I think it's important that we fight for kids to read the world and read the word. Like Paulo Freire used to say, we cannot just go for reading the word.
And the other thing
that
about
makes me think, oh, sorry, go ahead, Miriam.
Go ahead. The other thing about the illustrations, whether it's, you know, younger books for younger kids or graphic novels or comic books or whatever it is, a lot of these books are gateways to more complex reading. So why would you take away the enthusiasm? You know, if a kid, and it doesn't matter how old they are, you know, what the comment you heard, Nancy, about, you know, you're too old to read that book. I still love Beezus and Ramona. It's not something that you have to stop when you reach a certain age. And the illustrations are there to enhance the words and act as their own form of a story. So when kids engage with the illustrations, they're engaging with the narrative. And then they're more willing to engage with more narratives. And they will build. And just, you know, just 15 minutes a day of doing that will build that love of reading if we just leave them be. You know, if we let them do that.
My 11-year-old was a reluctant reader until I let her start reading. Not let her, but, you know, took her to find these kind of books and to find graphic novels. So she's actually leveled up from graphic novels to just novels with illustrations in them. But this is what she likes to read. So I'm not pushing Pride and Prejudice on her just yet, but she'll get there eventually. But she'll Amelia, when you were talking about like the learning to read, and what was the other piece?
Learning in the brain and reading in the brain. So those are the two. And I want Natasha. I want to talk to Natasha about it too.
It makes me think too.
Backstage after the show.
Yeah. It makes me think too of Louise Rosenblatt's theory of efferent and aesthetic reading, that you have to read aesthetically first. Like you have to love it and look at it and engage with it first and make meaning of it like personally first before you can learn content from it. So before we can start doing comprehension and comparing and contrasting and all that other stuff, you have to just be able to like appreciate the book for what it is and for the personal connection it makes within you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, American Reading was created by a teacher in Philadelphia. And she taught inner school Title I. And she determined one day, she goes like, I'm teaching these kids to read in a different way than I teach my own kids to read. I'm not doing that anymore. So she changed how she taught kids to read to match how she taught her own kids at home. And from that, she opened a company that today has over 300 people hired, you know, it's this equity spirit, this warrior spirit of why are you going to do something for somebody else's kids that you wouldn't do for your own kids? Don't do that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, and the other piece of that is, how can we help children who don't have that experience at home? You know, for example, over the last year, when a lot of schools have been, you know, just virtual as opposed to in person, my own kids, their reading skills grew because they had a mother with a background in literacy and ELA, and I knew what to do to help them. That puts them at a distinct advantage. But then, depending on what each student at home was experiencing, the levels of learning disruption were highly variable. So then as we're coming back, how are we thinking about helping kids who didn't have those at-home experiences and will continue not to have them so they can have that equitable access and opportunity?
Yeah, how can we address equity in more powerful ways when it comes to literacy?
Natasha, do you want to talk about it? I want to hear what you have to say on that one.
I mean, I don't know that I have anything new to add to what you guys have been talking about, but it infuriates me to see the disparities in ways that, you know, have really little to do with money. I mean, obviously money comes into play because it affects the quality of teachers that you can hire or it affects the quality of resources. But a lot of the things that you guys have talked about, you know, are things that can happen right now. But we have to cultivate that sense of learning, that light bulb that goes off that says, why should these kids over here get this style of instruction and opportunity, not necessarily based on resources, but on our approach to how we educate them and how we think about them as humans and their possibility versus these kids over here and how we approach them. I have literally been to schools where you can just see the difference. I mean, if you have a teacher that believes that kids should be able to express themselves or who nurtures an excitement around a certain topic or experience versus kids who are told to sit down, to be quiet, to raise your hand, to do these strict kind of discipline things. And we can see that going across the board, not just in the classroom, but how we discipline kids in different areas, in different demographics. And we see that in how we treat kids in our society. So it goes across the board. And what I hope that leadership, you know, in governmental positions, but also leadership in schools and grassroots leadership, that we can begin to nurture and cultivate that more than just policy around, you know, funding and things like that, because that to me is going to make the real difference.
Right.
Nancy, you know, there is more money coming to schools now than there has been in a very long time. And you just wonder what people are going to be doing, what choices, what investments. But I think we cannot act surprised, right? Like, let's stop. Let's just prepare and respond. But like in with ARC, when kindergartners come in the first week of kindergarten, if we see a kid that has never even held a book, has no print concepts, there's no label, no stigma. But for the first 30 days, they go on a read-to-me plan. And they are read 500 books in the first 30 days. There's no nothing. That's all you have to do. The same thing here. Like, let's stop acting surprised, guys. Right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
I need
and let's not attach a deficit to that child that we then use to offer them a different form of education instead of, you know, looking at it from an asset-based standpoint.
That's right.
Right, because we make so many assumptions about what kids can or cannot do, and very often with almost no information or with anecdotal information that is really sparse. And so, you know, what Amelia is saying, the best way to become a better reader is to read, and the best way to become a better writer is to write, and you actually also become a better writer by reading more. So it's surprisingly, it's like that Occam's razor theory where the simplest answer is often the best one. Just giving children more books will help.
Yeah. So I think we're going to have to like do a part two of this because I have a lot more questions and I would love to dig further into that issue as you're bringing up, Amelia, with the power and privilege when it comes to reading and, you know, the systemic inequities that exist. So perhaps you'll all join me back here in a couple of months and
I'll come back anytime.
And we'll pick up on part two. I do want to ask one final question because I see that my executive producer is watching from IBM TV and he asked the question, how about hybrid education? So let's just go around and what is a strategy, a suggestion, an insight that you could give to teachers who are now dealing with this hybrid environment for continuing to empower our readers? All right, who wants it first?
I'll take it because I've actually talked to a couple of teachers about this. I think the first thing we have to do is find out what students at home have. Mm-hmm. We have to get their voices. Student voice is the most powerful tool we have. Instead of hypothesizing about what kids need, we need to ask them what they need and what they have. So when we're talking about reading opportunities and literacy, do they have texts at home? If not, how can we get the text to them? And how can we engage them? And constantly circling back to the kids. They are the people we work for. And that's it.
I love it. I love it. All right. Natasha, any thoughts? Now, I know you're not a teacher, as you have said,
I'm not a teacher, but I completely agree with Miriam. I don't have children myself, but I'm very connected to my niece and nephew. And they're my niece is 17. And as I mentioned, my nephew is 6. So they're at a totally different stages. But that whole level of engaging them and talking to them about what they're learning, having them teach me things that they're learning has been, you know, a really good way to kind of, you know, I guess kind of take them out of that, the school idea, but also really disengage them around learning and feeling like they're excited about what they're learning. And I think, Miriam, what you said about just asking basic questions, I've often wondered, well, we're talking a lot about the deficits, but what do kids have? What don't they have? And why aren't we asking those questions and crafting solutions around that?
Right. Amelia, your thoughts on insights on hybrid learning to empower our readers.
So Nancy, I used your 5x5. Isn't that 5x5 that you had?
You mean my 5x5x5 to thrive?
Yes. Yeah. I am coaching.
We have that puzzle piece in the background. We could bring that up.
I would love it. But I think what's hard is for teachers to continue to triage, not to give up one-on-one time for the kids that need you most, and continue to experiment with the right balance of what can be taped across age levels, what can be a mini lesson. So your little grid was a big success in my school.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. We unpacked that and we started running improvement cycles. And when we started protecting time for one-to-one with kids that needed us the most, we are seeing kids show up more for things that they were not showing up for before.
Fantastic. And I go into detail on the 5555 to thrive in my new book, Reinventing the Classroom Experience, Learning Anytime, Anywhere, which I just presented at the World Education Summit. Very exciting. And it is shipping April 19th out of Routledge, but obviously you can get it on any of the online books. So thank you. And Carrie, what are your thoughts on hybrid learning and empowering our readers?
One of the things that I think about is back at the beginning of all this when the IDE kids read to each other. So my 11-year-old and 13-year-old were reading to the, you know, 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds in the company and just holding up the book and turning the pages and asking them what they thought about, you know, the different illustrations, because the illustrations are important. I don't know who out there needs to hear that, but they are important. And that, I think, is it's still reading. They're still engaged. I do think that kids need to hold books and turn the pages themselves, but this is a way for them to still be part of that community. So that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah. And Lauren, put that comment back up by Holly again. Also, one of our, I guess at the time she was 11 years old, 11 or 12, that was, we just decided when all of a sudden last March, everybody went home and, you know, all of our consultants were working remotely. We have a lot of consultants who have very young children and we wanted to do something to keep them, you know, busy. And so the older students were reading to the younger ones. And I remember, I love this comment and I didn't realize that, Holly, that through that little community of learners that we created that inspired Kyle to do some more reading. And then I remember even that the youngest students were looking, deciding that they would read to the older students. So there was a lot of wonderful things that came out of that. And my comment on hybrid would be, I know when schools did close in March, I began running webinars for parents on how to manage a home-based learning environment. And my whole point was you are not homeschooling. The schools are still providing the instructional framework, curriculum, et cetera. But you need to manage a home-based learning environment. You need to provide structures there. You need to provide a celebration zone. I have 8 elements of a home-based learning environment. And I think that's a big part of helping parents to empower their students in reading. So provide your parents with suggestions, techniques, and strategies for keeping their youngsters at home empowered in the world of reading. All right. Well, unfortunately, we've got to go. I've already run 5 minutes over, but luckily the producers like me. Well, I hope they do. We'll see if the show's canceled next week. It's because I abused the time. But anyway, thank you so much, Miriam, Natasha, Amelia, for being here. I love you guys. We are definitely doing a part 2. The audience has asked for it too. So Carrie is going to hit you up for a date in May and see if we can't come back and dive further into the equity aspect of this, because I think that'd be wonderful. I love you guys. Thank you so much for being here. Go backstage, but don't log off yet, because after the kids of IDE tell us a little bit something about their books and reading and why they like to read and their favorite books, etc., then I'll be backstage. Next week, our topic is prioritizing wellness. So I hope you will come, spread the word. We are here on IBMTV.TV, International Broadcast Media TV. Thank you so much for being here, live audience. Love you. See you next week.
I like to read because it's a good way to pass time. And it's fun.
The time I got immersed in a book was when I read Romeo and Juliet. I really enjoyed this book and it taught me a lot of valuable life lessons and I really enjoyed the dynamics of it.
My favorite book is The Little Girl. She loves to teach us that we love ourselves.
So these are my favorite books, Beautiful Oops and Pinkalicious, and Look Inside. And there's a lot of things in it. My brother likes to read it, too.
My favorite book is Junie B. Jones' Aloha, because Junie B. Jones is a good character. It's because she's so naughty and I like it.
When I get lost in a book, I feel all the emotions that the characters feel. When something happy is happening, I always feel happy. When something intense is happening, I always feel intense.
My favorite book is Stick Up For Yourself. It teaches you lessons, and it teaches you what to do and what not to do, and how to show emotion.
My favorite book is The Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, because it's about this kid named Greg who's in middle school just like me, and he also thinks he's the king of the world, which sadly he isn't. And so I like the story because it's from his point of view and what he thinks about the world.
My favorite part of the book is because it has flaps and because it has a snowman in it.
Thanks for watching Learning Unwrapped. Tune in next week to talk about prioritizing wellness. Self-care is important, folks.
At T-Mobile, we believe in putting people first by treating them right. So we've upped the benefits without upping the price. With Magenta Max, you get our best plan for 5G with unlimited premium data that can't slow down based on how much smartphone data you use. Plus, you'll pay zero cost to switch. And bring your phone. We'll pay it off up to $800. Only at T-Mobile.
Capable device required for 5G. Activate up to 4K or video streams at 480p. 40 gigs high-speed tethering. Up to $800 via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Support charges waived. See details at T-Mobile.com.
We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.